Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Welcome to episode 120 of the Chills at Will podcast. It's an absolute pleasure today to be joined by Tracy Kato Kiriyama. Tracy Kato Kiriyama, they and she, is author of Navigating Without Instruments, based on unceded Tongva land in the South Bay of Los Angeles. Tracy is an award-winning multidisciplinary artist, recognized for their work as a writer, performer, theater deviser. I want to ask about that one. That's great. Cultural producer and community organizer. As a storyteller and artivist, TKK is grounded in collaborative process, collective self-determination, and art plus community as intrinsically tied and a critical means toward connection and healing. She is a performer and principal writer for Pole Project Ensemble, two-time NET recipient, NEFA, N-E-F-A, 2021-22 finalist for their show Tales of Clamor. TKK presented for over 25 years in hundreds of venues throughout North America as a writer, actor, poet, speaker, guest lecturer, facilitator, artist in residence, and organizing slash arts and culture consultant. TKK has come to appreciate a wildly hybrid career with presenters including La Mama Cabaret, Onwave Theater, The Smithsonian, The Getty, Skirball Cultural Center, and Hammer Museum, to Zero Gravity, Grand Park, Whiskey A Go-Go, Hotel Cafe, House of Blues Foundation Room, and countless universities, art spaces, and community centers across the country. Their work is also featured in a wide swath of media and print publications, including NPR, PBS, Elle.com, Entropy, Chaparral, Canyon Press, Tia Chucha Press, friend of the podcast, Bamboo Ridge Press, Heyday Books, and Regent Press. TKK is a core artist of Vigilant Love, member of the HR 40 Coalition, and organizer with the Nikkei Progressives and NCRR Joint Reparations Committee, and director, co-founder of Tuesday Night Project, presenter of the Tea and Letter Writing Initiative and Tuesday Night Cafe series in Little Tokyo. Woo! Tracy, such a pleasure to have you. I'm so impressed at people like yourself who are just so involved in everything and, you know, just so involved in art and activism. How are you tonight?
I'm so great. Thank you so much, Peter, for having me.
Hello, it's a pleasure. There. It's a pleasure. Your name and your reputation precede you. I've heard great, great things. And so I was expecting a lot in reading the book, and I was, you know, the expectations were underwhelming. I was just like, wow. I was absolutely even more impressed than I thought it would be. The book is such an incredible, you know, work of art. And I know it's a collection, a culmination of all those years of writing and activism. So I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that. It was a long, long, long journey.
Well, I mean, I think for your bio, you should get an award anyway. That's just some great writing, you know, just in the bio. You know, like, that's skill. That is some skill. I wonder kind of, you know, some of the book, and I guess I'll ask you right away. I mean, you know, the whole idea of like the poet, the writer as speaker, are you pretty much like, hey, 100% me? Are you like, this is, you know, how does this, the speaker and the writer relate in this case?
Wow, that's cool to think about. That it kind of reminds me of my friend Zora Satchel, who says that, poetry shouldn't be read until you hear the author's voice first. And there's something to that. I think, you know, at a certain level, in terms of just even the basics of selling books, right? Like, poets have to go out with their books and read it out loud. And then people kind of go, oh, okay, I hear your voice. Right. your physical voice, your spiritual voice, your textual voice. Mm-hmm. And so now I get it. And I can take that with me when I'm reading the rest of it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I think for me, coming from a theater and performance background, I think that that has always affected my voice, mm-hmm. the sort of literal and figurative voice.
Right.
You know, yeah.
I mean, is it, you know, you're not trying to like nail you down. You don't have to give me like a percentage, like 93.6, you know, is it something where like, maybe this is like an exaggerated form of you or a minimized form of you?
Oh, in terms
or no
of
comment or no comment
in terms of this text. I mean, this is all right. me. This is
all this you.
This is kind of like, if I were to have a conversation with somebody,
of course,
how I would want to kind of, in some cases, start it or continue it or end
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, including with the notes to self and the notes to certain other people. That was my assumption. I didn't want to assume, you know, the idea. I don't want you to be like, no, this is, you know, a work of fiction. And, you know, what are you talking about? This is not me at all. but I guess the point I was getting at too is that, you know, so much of the book is autobiographical, about, hey, there's a beautiful looking cat.
Yeah, that's right? Honeycat.
The you know, about Gardena and about your family and about your background. I would just love to know, you know, growing up, your relationship with words, your relationship with language.
Yeah, well, my dad was a history teacher.
Okay.
And my mom was an English teacher. Yeah. They were both school teachers in adult education for Los Angeles Unified School District. And they were really big on history and language and stories, you know. My mom, when she was a kid, she would write plays for her school that would be performed all the time. And she really was my first English teacher. She would, every summer, we would have kids from the neighborhood over in our living room. Mm-hmm. And that would be our summer activity every day for weeks. We would take extra English classes with my mom. And, you know, I think she was an influence on me when it came to getting feedback on stories that I would write for school, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, I think that in addition to all of that, my parents, they had started this organization called the Japanese American Historical Society of Southern California in the 80s. Okay. So there would always be meetings at our house, and I was exposed to a lot of educators and historians and community activists, you know, and so they were the ones that really kind of instilled that sort of interest,
sure.
you know, beyond this thinking when I was a small child that, you know, history was boring. I really understood through them that the way I was learning it at school might be boring or not relevant or seemingly relevant and or incomplete for sure. So yeah, really having my parents kind of go, no, you, here's how you pay attention to it. Yes. Here's how to value it. Mm-hmm. That was a really big thing for me, I think.
Where did your curiosities take you? I mean, were you into like fantasy, sci-fi? Were you reading historical fiction? Were you reading, you know, above your age group, you know, as far as like reading adult stuff when you were a kid?
Gosh, you know, it's sort of a blur, maybe because it was just so long ago, but you know, I remember having this friend in middle school who had this like top 100 books that everyone should read, and
canon, right? The canon.
Yeah, and I that piqued my interest for sure in things like To Kill a Mockingbird or you know, somehow I think early on I picked up like Sylvia Plath and you know, some poetry in that vein. Didn't get a whole lot of it at school. I think a lot of my exposure in terms of storytelling, you know, one came through music. I mean, music was just a big part of my upbringing as just someone who danced before they could walk kind of person is what my mom always tells me. And so I don't know, I'm always fascinated by lyric, you know?
Yeah.
And then I would write really bad poetry as a child and like you know, exchange it with my friends, not really knowing what poetry was.
Sure.
And then later, yeah, you know, my parents would take me to a lot of theater. Nice. So I got exposed to storytelling, you know, in many shapes and forms. I think underneath all of it is storytelling, the orientation of storytelling, you know, and that was a big thing for me. Yeah.
Who were/are the great storytellers in the music? I mean, are we talking like Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy, Bob Dylan, like?
Oh my gosh, you're totally naming all of them. You know, okay. I mean, early on, you know, for me, it was like Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. I got introduced to Pink Floyd.
Okay.
You know, I was like this kid that grew up with sort of like Calabash cousins in the neighborhood, and they were about 5, 6, 7 years older than me. And so they would introduce us. They were all into different kinds of music, right? From like rock to heavy metal to, you know, Britpop. So, you know, it was exposure to a lot of different ways of telling stories through music, you know?
Right. And
yeah, so those were all really big for me.
So underrated, right? That idea of the older brother, sister, or friend or cousin who's 5 or 6 years older. They're at your level, but like they have a little more experience. And yeah,
they're like, hey, listen to this radio station or listen to this record, right? And otherwise I wouldn't know Depeche Mode. I wouldn't know Alice in Chains and you know, like all these different groups that you know, Tori Amos, and you know, just like different, very vastly different kinds of musicians and songwriters.
I'm gonna put it out into the universe. To have Tori Amos on the podcast would be how incredible is she, right?
Put it out
as
into
a songwriter, the universe. As a songwriter, I mean,
I just think people need to acknowledge her a lot more as a genius. Actually, it was my college friend that introduced me to Tori Amos, I think, with Little Earthquakes, just after she came out with that in 1981. And, you know, yeah, just like, wow.
Yeah.
The poetry there, right?
There you go. Someday I'll invite you on. You can be like the little window in the, you know what I mean? On the Zoom, you can be like,
oh my God,
just checking in.
You have to. It's set right now, everyone.
As you got into high school, college, you know, what were you reading? What was, you know, the name of the podcast is Chills at Will. Like what was thrilling you? What made you go like that kind of that double idea of like, man, I could never do this. This is incredible. And also like, I want to do this. I need to do this.
Well, you know, there was a performance artist. So again, this was not text that I was reading, but I was sort of soaking it in. A performance artist named Jude Nerita, because a part of my experience early on was also diving into performance. And so seeing somebody who was like an older Japanese American, beautiful actor, writer on stage, developing her own stories and playing all these different characters, and just the attention to every line that she was, you know, sending out to the audience, that was an influence for sure. You know, there were those plays like Wakako Yamauchi was a short story writer and a playwright. And she wrote this beautiful play called 12-1A. And then she also wrote And the Soul Shall Dance. And they're sort of, I think for Japanese American theater people, those are sort of like classics.
Okay.
The writing again is really gorgeous. So there was a lot of that. And then I think in terms of poetry, gosh, I mean, it's almost hard to start saying the list out loud, right? You know, for sure. People like Nikki Giovanni, Audre Lorde, Adrian Rich, Yusef Komunika, Rumi. I mean, you know, gosh, I could go on and on in that vein. And then to start to kind of get into the spoken word poetry scene and be, you know, exposed to really great spoken word masters, right? Then sort of the play with words and the performance of words, the kind of very palpable heart on stage, you know, really opened me up as well. C.K. Williams was another one that I would read and read and read. Eloise Klein Healy, Amy Uematsu, Janice Miri Kitani, Miri Kitani, I should say. So, you know, I like filling up, you know what I mean? It could be dance, theater, visual art, you know, it really to me is about filling up as an artist and a human being.
Right.
That the inspiration and the material is all around us, you know, and then beyond art form, there's issues in the world that we're facing constantly, and the communities that ground me and teach me and that I get to work with, that's a huge influence on my words, on my work.
I wonder, like, especially like in adolescence, were you like having to do with theater? Like, I always look back, it's like, I should have done theater. I should have done drama. Like, I just, you know, the idea to be able to avail yourself with words. And I was always pretty lucky. Like, I had, you know, family members who were really good at giving me those opportunities, even when I was shy as heck. Just a long way of asking, basically, like, were you already an outgoing person, or would you be like somebody who's kind of quiet and then you go to theater and like get it all out? Or was it just like, hey, I'm sociable already, this is just a natural extension?
I think it's kind of a mix. Like, when it came to moving my body and not speaking, I was one of those kids who, you know, like when you get to the school dance and everyone's taking off their shoes and you can only wear socks because you're in the gym, and then like everyone's sort of lining up and everyone's—
That wasn't you. You weren't in the corner. You weren't on the walls.
I was the first one on the floor.
Yeah, nice.
However, when it came to other things, like trying out for a school play, never.
Okay.
I remember my English/music teacher cornered me, and this was in middle school, and she's like, "You have a great voice. I want to hear you sing." She made me stay after class, and it freaked me out. I was just no, I don't think so. But, you know, I thought about it. Like, afterwards, I thought about it and thought about it, and I was like, why didn't I just take her up on that? You know what I mean? So in some ways, I'm like, oh, yeah, no wonder I became an artist. Mm-hmm. And then in other ways, I'm like, how did I finally just get the guts, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Very cool. As we, you know, in more recent years, being that you're somebody who's so just involved in art in so many different ways, you know, I usually ask very specifically, like, you know, what are you reading, or who is really inspiring you and pushing your own work forward? And I would ask you the same, but just who inspires you, just with that, is it 180 view or 360 view? You know, just the idea of you being such an artist, who's really inspiring your own art? Who do you like to read or listen to or watch?
Oh my gosh.
Again, a long list probably, right?
The list is very long. You know, one thing that I feel like I have to definitely say out loud is Critical Mass Performance Group and Nancy Keystone.
Okay.
They're definitely a big storytelling, theatrical, theater devising, performance influence and inspiration to me. They're a group to check out. For sure.
Okay.
The people that I get to work with, my stage partner, Kennedy Cavasaris, who's an aerial artist. So he does circus.
Oh, okay. I was like, aerial artist. I'm like, with a plane, with the cloud, with skywriting. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So he does like static trapeze and juggling and just all kinds of things. And he'll send me videos, or he'll post videos on his Instagram, and that inspires me for the writing that I do for our ensemble. The composer and sound designer that we get to work with, Howard Ho, amazing brain. And, you know, again, like, yeah, just I think in theater, I notice I'm talking about theater a lot, right? But because I think that is grounding for me. Sure. There's so much I'm influenced by, by all the people that I get to work with and learn from. I think what I love about being in LA in the poetry community or communities, you know, I would say like anyone, and maybe I'm biased, but I love all the writers that are published by Writ Large Press and the Accomplices, but also Kaya Press, which is based here in LA now, Not a Cult. You know, a lot of independent publishers, I think that's a great way to kind of, for me, to just find and read and you know, study lots of writers. We have so many right here in California and on the West Coast.
Yes,
and I just think that who are often overlooked.
Did you hear that, New York? Did you hear that, New York City?
Right? Come on, New York. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. It's like the center of the publishing world. You know, there's, you know, tons of literary foundations and groups all based on the East Coast. But man, I'm telling you, like, if you just even just go down the list of like the authors published by the Accomplices, like, you know, I you know, F. Douglas Brown, Rocio Carlos, Mike Songston. I mean, just, you know, folks that I just adore and and really respect and am super inspired by.
Yeah. Well, yeah, should just go down the list of your blurbs. I mean, there's some heavy hitters. There's some incredible works. You know, like you said, Douglas Brown, F. Douglas Brown, and Sarah Borjas. Man, Mike the poet. He's got the, you know, got it in his name. Man, just some great ones. Well, thank you for that. I know it's tough to like to even shrink down that list. It's such a big one. But I wonder about ideas of representation, maybe especially from childhood. Did, you know, all the different cultures, subcultures that make us up. Did you feel like, you know, I've been, you know, a lot of my guests have talked about mirrors and windows, you know, the idea of what they're reading as a mirror, as a window. How did you feel represented in all of your different ways growing up? If not, you know, I mean, where did you find representation? What kind of struggles do you think we still have?
I think that's a great question in terms of positioning that as a reflection on childhood. I am very lucky that my parents kind of opened the floodgates for me at an early age in a few ways, and that even as public school teachers, they would just remind me that when they would take me to meetings and conferences and pilgrimage to Manzanar every April, where they were both put during World War II, they would remind me that I had to pay attention and I had to talk with people of different generations, and I would learn a lot through people. And that is probably the principal way I still learn to this day.
Sure.
Through conversation, you know, or even through a conversation, being guided towards certain things to read and to watch and experience. So I think, you know, that juxtaposed with, say, growing up in Torrance, where my experience in elementary and middle school and high school, you know, the number of Japanese American kids, we were so small that like people would call us Little Tokyo. And so I remember, it must have been middle school, watching 16 Candles and feeling conflicted in my chest, in my body, watching it, like really liking the Long Duk Dong character because of the way that the actor was portraying a sweetness in that person. But when the movie was over, my friend's parents making these like gong sounds at me and sort of like mocking the way he talked. And then, you know what I mean? Then it was like that part of me that felt like, ooh, I might be able to value this person performing, but I also got this sense that people were laughing at him and therefore laughing at me, right? So that was the kind of representation, so to speak, that I saw and experienced. Yeah. And thank goodness for Bruce Lee. I mean, he was long past by the time I was born, but I was convinced that he was still alive when I was in the fifth grade. And, you know, so I did have certain people like that I, you know, like sort of latched onto. I was convinced, you know, I would read comics as a kid and I would read Wonder Woman. And because the way she was illustrated with like black hair, I thought maybe Wonder Woman might be Asian, you know? So it's like this thing of like trying to insert and project, right? Like all these things that we need and want to see. And, but thankfully I had my parents to fill in the rest and never make me, so I didn't ever feel too wrought with like angst about that, because I felt like, oh, you know, what's cool is that I get to see these like independent films. They would take me to film festivals, like Asian American film festivals, you know, and again, to theater, like with, they would take me to the big shows, but they would also take me to like, this like performance artist in some little place, you know? So I got to really see my folks like on stage, on screen, you know?
I mean, I know of the like, ridiculously racist character that you're talking about from 16 Candles. I've never seen 16 Candles. You were talking about how, like, you know, you saw it and you saw the sweetness. You know, it's not an exact comparison, but you know how like there's been a lot of like not revisionism, but I guess like revisiting the idea of like, let's say minstrel dancers, right? Or minstrel performers, right? How so many of them were very like wink, wink, right? Like knowing what they were doing, playing the part. Do you know what I'm saying? Was there some of that in that movie, or was it, no, that was just a movie written with a very, you know, in a very racist way? And
I mean, I think like there's two things at play there. There's the actor and the choices that they're making and the job that they're trying to fulfill in making a rich character. And I do think that the actor Gedi Watanabe did do that, but it's within the context of a piece written, directed and produced to laugh at that character. I don't think it was they might have tried to tell themselves that they developed a sweet character, but you know, it was when you watch it, it's very obviously for a comical effect. And even like the sound design, they had like these huge gongs, you know, it was like over the top. And not over the top in like a Christopher Guest kind of like Spinal Tap way. It was like over the top in terms of like a John Hughes in the 80s, not knowing how to like treat people of color in their films. Right. So, so watching it, I felt all of those things.
Sure.
Felt like, I did feel a heart connection to what this character could have been and what I wanted it to be. And yet you're still watching it through the lens, not of that character. You're watching it through the lens of the filmmaker and the writer, right? Looking and the other characters who are all white. You're looking at that character. So that's the gaze. That's like the white gaze, right? That we're experiencing.
That's the dictionary definition of the white gaze right there.
Thank
you for that. I appreciate that. You know, we'll dip in and out of the book because, you know, it's so you know, tied in with your life. Talking about that, the movie situation reminds me, you know, so one of the works in Navigating Without Instruments is about your mom on like December 7th, right? So was she teaching up in the Valley? Am I correct on that? Or
she was, and you know, I have a funny revealing story about that particular piece. Okay. So, and this is a really interesting thing about how memory works. I had published that piece, I think, in like the Rafushimpo, which is a community newspaper. I had published it somewhere. She had seen it and she corrected me. She told me that I got the room number wrong.
Oh, no.
So I changed it to room 25, I think it is in the book. Okay. Then, so this is years ago. Then the book comes out. A couple weeks ago, I'm at her home and she's like, oh, I have some notes. And I was like, okay. and she's like, that December 7 piece, that didn't happen. You're thinking about when I was in school and the teacher on December 7 made all the kids talk about all the things that the Japs did to them. And
you, Tracy, or your mom?
My mom was in elementary school, in the 50s, and you know, every December 7 or on this particular December 7 there was my mom and one other Japanese American kid in the class, and the teacher was like, okay, we're gonna talk about the things that the Japs and the Japanese did on December 7, and somehow I must have mixed that in with with this this thing that happened in those days called Kilajap Day. I think I morphed it all in my mind for some reason, but at the same time I was like, Mom, you've read that piece before. Like the only thing you corrected me on was the room number. Like, so I don't know, like sometimes with that particular piece, it's such a trip. Cause I'm like, where did I blend it? And where?
That's so interesting.
You know what I mean? So I hope Monroe High doesn't hate me for that. But I'm like, okay, let's see. So how do I guess on my website, I'll write about this. So I think I sort of combined three different things.
Okay. Well, so like, you know, I was reading that and I'm like, okay, you know, this isn't something where it's like a happy ending. Like, you know what? Everyone figured out they were wrong. But like, so I was trying to get from that poem, was there like the sense of like your mom being there and being so well respected that the students were like, oh, it's not, you know, Japanese people with a big group. It's her and others and individuals. Am I like oversimplifying that? Was there a little bit of that in there? Like not a happy ending, but like a kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah. There is this book by Michi Weglin, which is a classic. If anyone wants to study about the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans into American concentration camps, Michi Weglin's Years of Infamy is a classic. And so that's why I wanted to kind of end on the note of a day that would live in infamy. Mm-hmm. And how that might be something that those kids, maybe that day I imagined, you know, some of this, right, is imagining things. So when you ask about reality and fiction, maybe that's where there is some fictionalized, you know, projections, right? So, mm-hmm. So I thought of it like knowing how much my mom's students loved her, like they will to this day search for her and tell me stories about how awesome she was for them, that I feel like those kids couldn't have missed the ways in which she reacted to certain things happening. So for instance, the kind of like the reality portion of that for her as a teacher at Monroe High, there was somebody who did come on the loudspeaker and say that it was December 7. And like the, you know, it was sort of like talking about when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And my mom stopped her whole lesson and she used the rest of the class to sort of talk about her own experience. And then word got around to that kid who made that announcement. And he was also a student of my mom's and he like ran over to her to apologize.
Okay, I see.
So that's what actually quote unquote happened. And So I think that for me, when I think about her students going through that time period in you know, like the 60s when she was teaching and when every December 7 would roll around, I really believe that she had students and I've been told by her students that because of her, they were able to kind of like look at things differently and personalize for themselves what happened to her.
Right.
You know, so that for me, to me, maybe that day is a different kind of day of infamy for those kids. Upon meeting her, you know.
Thank you for that. Let's dive into the book a little more. It's called Navigating Without Instruments. It's got out in parentheses. I'd love to know the seeds for the book, the idea of the title and the interesting way that you punctuate it.
Yeah. So I worked on it for over 8 years. Chi-Won Choi from Writ Large Press, we were doing this like LA tour with Ed Lin. And by the end of that, he was like, hey, what are you writing next? I want to publish it. And that was 2012. And I was like, oh, okay, I can start working on it like middle of 2013. And I started telling folks, oh yeah, I think I'll have something out in like 2014.
famous last words, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so there were many different iterations, many different pieces that I'd taken in, put out, put back in. But the one thing that kind of was around from very early on was the title, Navigating Without Instruments. And let me see if I can grab it over here. There are these survival guides I'm very, very obsessed by and obsessed with and inspired by these survival guides that come from like the 40s and 50s.
Okay.
And this one, it just says like survival, jungle, desert, Arctic, ocean.
Ooh.
And literally there's like no copyright page. It just says United States Army Air Forces. And that's it. And it just goes right in. Office of Flying Safety Education Division. That's it.
That made it onto your title page, I think, right? Or your copyright, one of those. Or maybe the back notes or something.
Yeah. So there are these icons.
Yes. Okay.
So what it is, there are these icons that come from some of these guides, and this one in particular, where if you were stranded with your airplane, you would have this piece of paper that was like blue and yellow, and I think striped on one side. And depending on how you folded it and left it with your airplane, it would communicate what your situation was.
Like a Morse code type of thing.
Yeah. So the first one in the book. And so I ended up using all 12 from this particular survival guide. And I wanted to utilize it to separate the sections of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I was only going to use 9. I really wanted, for whatever reason, to have 9 sections. But when I was finally putting everything in order, it ended up being 12
right.
category piles of pieces. And then I just started to mix and match and like figure this out. And then it was like this puzzle, you know? And it all, totally, to me in my brain, it totally made sense what ended up with what. And so, so in one of these, I think it was a completely different book, but there was in one of the table of contents, it said something like navigation with instruments, something like that. And so ever since then I was like, ooh, navigating without instruments. And then putting the out in parentheses, it allows me to kind of read it in a few different ways.
Uh-huh.
Navigating with instruments, navigating without instruments. Also as a queer person, navigating without instruments. You know what I mean? Like I think if the book is any indication in terms of varied form, I need to have options.
I need to
have like variants for things to make sense to me.
Right.
And for whatever reasons, that just stuck with me. And I always, you know, I would return to it. And I would always say like, okay, is what I'm doing still matching this title? And I would just kind of check in like, okay, that's still the, that's just still sort of the anchor. That's still sort of the guiding point.
Wow. Blown away. So cool. The creativity with that. I love the idea of the muse. I mean, you know, your family, for sure, your grandfather specifically, Fukuya.
Oh, Michio Fukaya. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see that, right? I mean, even like references to like Anne Hetch and, you know, Joshua Bennett and Rocio Carlos and, you know, is it Taz Ahmed.
Yeah, Ahmed. Taz.
And, you know, in like the letters back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you seek out muses or do you feel like that's something that kind of comes naturally?
Oh, they disappear.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize my grandfather was a muse until I was literally putting this book together.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working on our play, Tales of Clamor, I was really trying to figure out like what my particular character's motivation was. And and I was like, oh, okay, underneath all of this is she's carrying pain that her grandfather never got to see justice. You know, I don't think he felt repaired. He died in 1978. And so, you know, so he just kind of appeared, I think, as like, hey, your grandfather's coming up a lot. In my first book, Signaling, my dad came up a lot, you know, and, you know, and when I was writing in my 20s, like my mom, and she still does, my mom always will come up for me.
Yeah,
for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, what is such a strong verb, right? The idea of repaired and reparations and can you repair something? And yeah. you humorous is not the way, but just a very kind of like more of a lighthearted, but also a very honest look at like reparations and, you know, what do I do with this check? And, you know, if I'm bouncing up and down in the bank line, I don't know if I'm saying it exactly right, but just the idea of like, what does that mean to get a check? You know, how do you, you know, I'm not saying anything original, like how do you, money is not going to erase all of the traumas and the, you know, but it's something. And, you know, we can talk more about that in a minute, but, you were talking about, I guess form too. You were talking about like, you know, the punctuation, that's so cool. I would think, okay, without could have, you know, two meanings, but oh man, a third one, maybe even, you know, even more. That's so cool. You have, you know, repetition, you have un, you have a poem, I think it was unabated, I'm forgetting the exact name, but it's, you know, it's a repetition of un. You play with columns. There's some where it's like, I think, and I want to ask you about that. Some I think you can maybe read straight down the left column, but also left to right. Mm-hmm. You have some that are very spaced out that, mm-hmm. I guess force you to, you know, I would love to know. I mean, I know you have so many different that it's hard to just say one, but I wonder kind of what your just general philosophy is about form and format.
Yeah. Possibly because, you know, I have, yeah, many different influences, right, in writing, mm-hmm. as I think all writers do, or most do, or many do. I trust the process more than anything. I trust the process and allowance and permission to put words on the page in a manner that feels right. And then from within, during that process, mm-hmm. start to formulate rules that I can then keep anchored by. Okay. Meaning, so one of the first pieces, remember all the children whom were never born to me.
Yes.
When I wrote that, when I started writing that, I felt in my gut that I needed a lot of space on the page between phrases, between words within a phrase. I think maybe because I don't exactly know, actually. I think this is the one piece, this one and the one right after it, Redream, Curly Haired Cutie Pie. In every reading that I've given thus far since the book came out a few months ago, no matter what, I start there. Mm. I don't exactly know why. We'll have to have a conversation like a year from now. But I think something about it that I'm noticing is that I feel like it was the right hunch to go with, because it feels it's a hard piece in that, mm-hmm. it's very 100% real. And those children that I imagined are like 100% real in my imagination. Not having them is 100% real, you know? And so there's something about having some space when I'm reading through it. It allows me to slow down. It allows me to be within each child that I imagined. And I don't know, to just kind of go through a process with that. And sometimes there are other pieces where I want the words super close together and I just want it in a chunk. I think with all the death moments, those are mm-hmm. a little bit more abstract, and I wanted to let myself have that permission too. Mm-hmm. I'm super huge on clarity. I want the readers who say they don't like poetry. I do, yes. honestly.
Yes.
And I have a lot of older readers. I'm starting to have younger and younger readers, you know, like, and so, yeah, I feel like within a collection, every so often for me, I feel like, okay, when the death moments come, I'm just going to dive. Cause also those are really hard. I don't necessarily want to be exact. It's okay for some mystery to exist there as long as it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. I mean, I really go all around with form, and I think with like the things that come throughout in terms of notes to self, notes to community, notes to mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. for me, the rule there was like, what is my honest, what is this honest like thought that's emerging after I read through the piece? And it can't be to explain the piece. It's just more of like a natural, like actual thought that's entering into my brain of maybe it's like a little thorn on the side of the piece. Maybe it's a little bit of a little jab, a little joke, a little nudge forward, you know, a little reflection, something I want to remember, you know? So I do think that there are all these rules as we go along that we apply and we start to create in order to keep like anchored in the form while we're writing it.
Right.
That's how I try to approach it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the first piece, refresh my memory on the piece, To All the Children, right?
Yeah. Remember All the Children Whom Were Never Born to Me.
I mean, a beautiful piece and there's so that one and so many throughout the collection, there's so much of a, what if there's so much of, I mean, to me, that makes sense. The space is, you know, it's almost just as important as what's not said, what's not written.
Yeah.
Right. Because you give us those little, you give us enough that it's like, oh boy. And it makes you think, and it's like, it does allow us to catch up, if you will. One of so many lines that was so beautiful and was basically like a, what if your grandfather, who like you said in a few words, but it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us, is just kind of like, oh, he grew up in a different generation, and you know, who may not have been accepting or as accustomed to like same-sex relationships, that kind of thing, right? And so it was like, go ahead.
Well, that was so yeah, there's a piece called Where We Would Have Gone,
right?
And that's actually to my father.
Pardon me.
Oh, no worries. But I'm just like, oh yeah, I guess I don't exactly say it.
Well, no.
But it could be read as my grandfather. Yeah, no, for sure. So this was to my dad, George Kiriyama. And it's really a piece for him and my partner, Joyce. But yeah, sort of thinking about how, I love that you bring up the what ifs, because that piece right there is definitely that whole idea of like, hey, I believe that I do have an ability to predict the past. And like, if we could have rolled back, I think he would have been cool. I think he would have been fine. I think he would have seen Joyce as like the person that she is. And he would have been like, all right, you're on track finally, you know?
I don't know if understatement is the word, but it's like, okay, if I were to see this sentence out of context, it's like, oh, that's cool writing, whatever. Like, but the line is, I'm okay, kid. I'm doing okay. But in context, it's like, whoa, that would be that. This is that imagined conversation. And just, you know, just on a human level. And it's just like, oh man, like that is so beautiful. And, you know, it's like, I don't know if I'm doing exact justice to, there's that Portuguese word that I cannot remember that means it's like a nostalgia for something you never had.
Oh. You know, wow, I need to learn it.
Yeah, I may be conflating two things, but the idea of like a nostalgia for something you never had. So it's like you said, predicting the past. And I just love that idea of like this imagined conversation. And it's not some crazy off the wall experience. It's just normal, you know, every day. We went on a cruise and wham. So, you know, obviously like the spectrum of sexuality, if you will, is definitely a theme. One of the lines, maybe from a family member, was something like, still queer. It seemed like you got a laugh out of it, right? Like maybe not. I mean, that word still like has so much to say, right? It's such a powerful word. I wonder just in general too, about the nomenclature of like, of queer. Is it in 2022, is it still this idea of like, you know, it was often used in the past to put down, it's been reclaimed. Or do you see it as more than that or different than that?
I think by now it's been like totally reclaimed. And so I'm very happy to live in this particular age of both having that word as like a solid for me, but also because, you know, I've had many relationships with cisgendered men and, you know, I've had relationships with all kinds of spirits and bodies and beings. And until I heard the word pansexual, like bisexual never felt right to me. That felt before I understood the word binary many years ago.
Okay.
It felt like a binary, right? It was too much like, you know, but what about, you know what I mean? What about if you're not a so-called woman or man, you know what I mean? Mm. Like there are so many different ways to not just express, but there are many different ways that people feel their gender or their being beyond gender, beyond the G word, you know? Okay. And so when I heard the pronouns they, as an avenue, like I see words as avenues, right? Avenues. That you can kind of walk down and start to understand more. And I, that again was like at a gut level, like, oh, that feels right. Mm. I feel like such a they, and I do feel like a she. So that's why my pronouns are they and she. And yeah, so to me, it has to feel right. It has to, for me to like, for it to come out right. Even my name, Tracy, sometimes when people say it to me, it doesn't feel right.
Okay.
But when they say Trey or TKK and it just rolls out of their mouth like that and they feel comfortable, then I feel comfortable.
Yes.
Does that make sense? Like a partner I had before would always say like, honey, or whatever, but in public would say Tracy. And I would like, I'd be like, what? That sounds so formal and distant. Like, why do you, what? Like, it's okay to call me whatever, you know what I mean? So it's that kind of thing. Like you could grow up your whole life with a certain thing that you're called and it not feel right.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. So.
Well, yeah. If anybody knows, I mean, words matter, and that you definitely are an absolute wizard with words. I love the idea. I think you quoted an author. I don't remember the person's name, or a writer of some sort, but this idea of like a collective coming out.
Mm.
But you also were like, hey, you know, that's, be careful. Right. Like it's a great idea, and it could work in many ways, but you know what I'm talking about, but it's like, okay, but not everyone, that doesn't work for everyone. And here's why. And I thought that was like, oh, really interesting.
Yeah. That was like one of my longest acronyms, I believe. It was one of the longest note two.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
And I still have to look at it.
It's around page 220, maybe?
Page 220. Let me take a look.
Ish, right around there.
Yeah, let's take a look. Let's see. Page 220. Right. Maybe it's right before then. Oh, yeah. NTAOUQ.
Ooh.
It's probably note to allies of us queers, is what I'm thinking. Yeah, you know, it just talks about like an ally uncle, you know, kind of proclaiming when we were planning this conference, like, I just want everyone to just come out and like, I think he's Christian. So there was this kind of testify sort of vibe.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I think he kind of wanted that idea. Like if everyone would testify, but they're testifying being out. Like, I think that's what he imagined, like this room exploding and like people like being, I'm out,
you know? Clapping. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, that's cool that you want that, but not everybody wants that.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the goal. Right. Coming out is not always the goal. Like letting in, that's your privilege if you're let in.
Sure.
That's your honor. But that's not like the goal always.
You know, there are the death notes. I don't know, 5, 6, maybe even more that are throughout. And they, you know, there's laughter even in some of this, some of the horrors. I mean, there's, a car accident, maybe what, age 16 or so?
Yeah.
You know, even like musings on like suicide, especially with like maybe older people. You quote some of the stats about the 65 to 84 demographic with Asian Americans.
Yeah.
One of the lines is forget the dead, which again, out of context doesn't make a lot of sense, but you know, this idea of how to live in this world. And one of your really good lines, this is, I believe, pretty much verbatim, is from the poem called For My Friend Who Says She Doesn't Need Therapy, quote, something about strategies for survival as a kid. I'm sorry, I'm not quoting directly, but, you know, certain strategies that were for survival as a kid, they become tethers as an adult.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I was like, ooh, yeah. I literally can't snap, but I would have if I had the ability to snap. But I can't think of anything more, you know, horrific in some ways and traumatic and tough than these, all these instances with being close to death. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide, or how did you decide to include those? And what was the process like? Was that difficult? Was it like you were re-victimized in some ways?
No. So, you know, in the earlier years when I was working on this, a couple things were sort of shared with me that were critical, I think, in this whole process. One, Chiwan, my editor, publisher, would remind me that it was fine that I was writing into many different memories and stories and experiences and relationships. Mm-hmm. He was just like, it can be a big book. Just remember that you're the narrator and that's the anchor. We're always anchored in the narrator, and that's you. So that allowed me to go, yeah, whatever comes, and we will figure out how to weave it together later.
Okay.
The other thing that was said to me, because I was like, everything with this book was like feeling like really like, not just serious, but, and not just heavy, but really important.
Yeah.
To me. And my friend offered me this wonderful paraphrased quote from a playwright, Philip Congotanda, who said to him at one point, write what it is you need to say, or you will die if you don't. Write what it is you need to say, or you will die if you don't. That quote, I was like, ah, that's the bar for this book.
Okay.
It cannot be the bar for every project. That's right, way too intense, right?
That's, yeah.
It doesn't match all everything in it, and it shouldn't. My God, I don't think, not for me, and not for Sanity. And so, but that made sense to me with this book.
Okay.
And so I was like, okay, so that's why I have to, because I need to allow for the hard shit, like the hardest stuff. I need to allow for the hardest stuff. And that's why I don't even call them near-death experiences. I just call them death moments, because
death moments, yeah.
There are certain things where, like the accident, for instance, that you mentioned at 16, I was like, sure. I was like 100% positive. It was done. It was quiet. My life did not flash before my eyes. It was just quiet. Mm. It was peaceful. And I said the word, okay. I said, okay. As soon as I said, okay, boom, like all the lights were back, you know, I'm like in the side of the car, the, you know, the jaws of life are coming, you know, there's like all the sirens, you know, the two people I'm sandwiched in between, you know, like all of it.
Wow.
But for that moment, before I said, okay, you know what I mean? And so that's what it was. So to me, that's not near death. I don't know. I think that was a death moment.
I see.
You know what I mean?
There's a distinction there. Oh my gosh. You use bury so interestingly, like as a command. What were you going for with bury? I mean, it's repeated many times.
Yeah. Well, let me grab my cat as I say. Bury. Let me actually take a look at it while I'm,
of course,
talking about it. Because I know that I use that quite a bit in probably most, if not all, of those pieces. And I just want to be specific.
Yeah, of course. Is that buried in memory? Is that buried in the ether? Is that, I mean?
I think it's like, in the moment of writing that, it was like me telling myself, that moment is done. We can bury it. Mm-hmm. It will always exist in my mind, but we can bury it. We can lay it to rest.
Okay.
And I think it's also, I think reading it out loud, it's like this reminder, hopefully to the reader, and definitely for myself, that we have these things that are hard to face, that are hard to think about, but they're right there under the surface.
Sure.
And so even just saying it out loud, it's okay, and sometimes it's necessary. But sometimes it helps if we're acknowledging that, you know, we're putting that, we're putting it down. We're putting it to rest, to pause.
That makes a lot of sense. Ideas of home, ideas of family, ideas of racism and resistance, all of those, fortunately or unfortunately, are very much linked in your family, in your particular case. You talk about finding, I think, maybe an older photo of your grandpa from the internment camps, from the concentration camps, and he had a beard.
Yeah.
And what did that beard symbolize, or what did that beard really? Oh, there it is.
There it is. So see that guy right there with the beard?
Oh, that's a beard. That's definitely a beard. Whoa.
And he's the only one in this photo that has a beard. He's smack dab in the middle. There's a museum in Independence north of Manzanar.
Okay.
So Manzanar is like on your way to Mammoth.
Right.
About 4 hours northeast of Los Angeles County. And he was a farmer during his stay, experience of being incarcerated at Manzanar. Uh-huh. And every April, the last Saturday of April, there's a pilgrimage to Manzanar. Everyone can go. You can go. I encourage everyone someday to join. I think this year is going to be virtual. Hopefully next year it'll be in person again. But a lot of buses come in from everywhere. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people go. But Independence that weekend, there's a museum. I think it's the Independence Museum. Mm-hmm. And they bring out all of their Manzanar things. And when I was a kid going to Manzanar, there was this panorama picture. So that's just like the picture I showed you, is just like the middle slice of it. It's like this long panoramic photo. And I remember my brother staring at it. He's like, "That's Grandpa." And then so we got like pictures taken of that. Mm-hmm. And I'd wondered about that. I tried to ask people. I asked everybody who could tell me anything about that beard, because no other pictures of my grandpa, he didn't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's what I write about in that piece, about my Uncle Tommy, thankfully telling me a great story. So many of the stories I've heard about my grandfather over the years, just always heartbreaking. And so it was like such a gift to hear him just say, you know, he did it out of protest and he didn't need to look pretty in camp. Yeah. It was just like the angels broke, you know, like, oh yeah, that's so righteous and cool. Mm. And it was his own thing. No one told him to do it. He did it on his own terms. Jeez. Like maybe the one thing he had control over.
Hmm.
You know?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. You know, there's obviously, I mean, themes of racism. Mm-hmm. You know, you have one of your pieces is devoted to, you know, the idea of the comfort women.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, which seems to be like it should be such a basic thing, but you did it, you wove it in so carefully and so smoothly, the idea of like the survivors are the one who should speak.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Don't say, well, no, what they were trying to do, just let's talk to the survivors. They are the ones who know. That's mm-hmm. it, right? Who else is there? Resistance.
That's right.
A great quote: "My mother's anger formed my bones." This mm-hmm. great image, and I can totally picture it in 2022 even, but like your mom, you know, polite conversation with the lunch ladies, and then getting into like you know, quote unquote, being too political.
Yeah.
Right. And she, you know, you write here, quote, "She is not only my link to our family's trauma, but is the courage unlocked from deep inside our ancestral sinew." You got to copyright that, ancestral sinew. I mean, that's mm-hmm. you know, the marrow, right down to the deepest.
Yeah.
You write about Yuri Kochiyama,
mm-hmm.
just passed away recently. Did mm-hmm. you gave like a speech in what was that all about? You gave a speech in honor of her?
Yeah, in 2014, because Yuri had such massive impact and worked with so many people, there were three memorials for her. There was one in Harlem, one in San Francisco, or was it Oakland, but Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
and one in Los Angeles. And so the organizers of the Los Angeles Memorial invited me to write and share a piece. And boy, oh boy, did I take that like the ultimate, with ultimate seriousness.
Yeah.
I did not allow myself to procrastinate on that by any means. And I was like, I'm going to do my very best to do her honor and give her honor. And, you know, I met her through one of my big sisters, Karen Ishizuka, when I was working at the Japanese American National Museum. And she just walked into the office one day because her daughter-in-law was working in the same office that I was working in, Allison's office. And it was like a hot summer day. And I'm not a starstruck person. Yuri was the one time I was like, I got the sweats and I was just like, oh my God, what do I say? What do I ask her? Can I bother her? I don't want to bother her. She looks like she's taking a break. You know, but then she was just Yuri. She asked me all these questions and she wrote my name down in her little notebook. She always carried these little notebooks, which I do now. And, you know, just wrote down things. And the next time I saw her, she was like, oh, Cal State Fullerton. You know what I mean?
Amazing.
She just remembered things. And so, yeah, so I wrote that piece. And that was one piece that because it's lengthy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book was getting long and I was like, maybe I should take that piece out. And I said that to some of the people who did blurbs, and Dorothy Randall Gray wrote me back and was like, don't you dare take out the Gary Kochiyama piece. Yes. Yes. You dare. Yeah. So I was like, okay. Yeah.
As you wrote about so well, I mean, you know, a lot of people know her as the one who was cradling Malcolm X's head, but you know, she was so much more than that.
Absolutely.
And I love the idea of collectiveness, the collectivity, the idea you talk about that she remembered everyone and she, hey, let me tell you, here's someone to go see. And it sounds like that you've definitely, and even before you met her, you've done that. You've taken after her and you have, you know, this idea of the collective art space. And so, you know, I'm just so impressed that at you and people like her, nostalgia interrupted, your family's history interrupted with the camps. In reading about Yuri, I saw that she was born in San Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
Is where I used to teach, mm. used to live, which of course, you know, has Terminal Island, which used to be a Japanese fisherman, you know, village, but doesn't mm-hmm. really, you know, exist. And just reminds me about how much history is not that far behind, you know, it's not that far away, right?
Yeah. And like, you know, thankfully so many people take after Yuri and those folks have taught us and, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, just, I feel like a very, you know, a great responsibility and a great privilege, you know, to be a part of this massive continuum of amazing organizers and community people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, continuum is a word, right? And you write on multiple occasions about the 8 billion and 100 billion. So 8 billion is the number in the world right now, is that right?
We're close to it. There's this app that I am crazy about. It's called World-O-Meters or Worldometers.
Okay.
But it's fascinating. Like it just, it shows you like the people being born, the people dying, you know, it's just like this like crazy meter. Yeah, but you know, they're estimated about 100 billion recorded who have died. Mm. And that's a lot of energy, right? That's a lot.
Sure. Oh my gosh, it is. I love the back and forth. I've always, you know, I feel like it's an old, very, very old fashioned thing. You know, they'd have like, they publish a book of like letters from, you know, Faulkner to Hemingway, your correspondence with Taz Ahmed, and you know, I'd known about her a bit, and you brought me to Wikipedia and her page. I'm like, oh yeah, and just this idea of, again, the what if, and knowing more about your families and the connections that your families have, the differences they have, and just that connection is. I wonder about that relationship between the two of you. How it fosters growth and creativity and writing.
Yeah, you know, Taz really gave me a gift and gave us a gift and like, you know, wrote this beautiful piece and the way she put it was dedicated to my JA allies, and she sent it out to a bunch of us. And I mean, I think I pretty much started writing instantly.
Hmm.
It just, I felt like I needed to respond. Oh. It was such a beautiful poetic prompt, absolutely, to continue the verse, right? And to converse with her through our poetics. And then that led to us kind of just building more and more pieces and, you know, getting to go out to places like the Smithsonian and, mm-hmm. you know, grand performances, you know, just to do these pieces out loud in public with witness. Mm-hmm. And that was, that's another gift in itself. But yeah, you know, I think towards the end, the third letter that I included in this one was much more recent, and it kind of turns more on our health and right. our situations of relating to each other in that way, in a way that I didn't necessarily, I never want to relate to people around sickness, but yet that's our world, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you for that. You know, definitely a family of resistance, a family who knows its history. I mean, you had two great curators with your, you know, of your reading with your teacher parents, professor mm-hmm. parents. Eminent domain. I mean, I used to exit at 405 and Artesia.
Mm.
So I know, you know, 405 and Crenshaw and Eminent Domain, and just, what is that, 15, 20 years after the camps?
I think it was somewhere around 10 to 12 years. Yeah, okay. I was in the late 50s, I believe. I've just this year started to poke around asking people, hey, who do I talk to about Eminent Domain records, you know, like, because my mom doesn't even, I don't think she's ever seen them. I'm sure that my grandparents threw all that stuff away. Right. So, yeah.
But just about just that through line, that continuum of resistance, that continuum of, you know,
pain.
Of pain.
Mm-hmm.
You say it much better than I do. Mm-hmm. We would be honored to hear something from you if you're up for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. Why don't I read two?
Please.
If that's okay. So, since we're talking so much about my grandfather, and it is April, and I'll reiterate that the last Saturday of every April is the pilgrimage to Manzanar. Mm. And Manzanar is a national historic site because of the efforts of people like Sue Embry and the Manzanar Committee, who really fought for it to be a place that we could visit, right? Because, you know, the government did not intend for us to remember these places.
Mm. Yes, that's a great point.
And so... Yeah. I think it's important for us to remember that, like, we weren't given these things. We were not given redress. Everything is fought for. And, you know, for me as an activist now, in deep support and solidarity of Black reparations, and, you know, also in support of land back issues for Indigenous folks, and just trying to study more and more. Mm. It's wild to me, even as an Asian American studies minor, and I took a bunch of ethnic studies courses, like, it's wild to me how much there's still to learn about our actual history in this country. Right. So this was for my grandfather. So it begins with a dedication, dedicated to all the ancestors who died before knowing that redress and reparations would be a thing to come or to be fought for in the future we call now. No redress. No museum, no monument, no poem, no song can house the spirit of a past soul like that of my grandfather, who died before justice could meet the old man at his mailbox. Grandpa never got to stand in line at the bank, 3 inches taller, with redress check in hand, 1 foot in front of the other, feeling grounded again. Never got to deposit an apology in his savings account. Never got to wonder of how he might spend this money on new equipment for the nursery, or a truck for himself, or college money for his grandchildren, or for once take the most takai cuts from the fish truck man. Most years in April, I attend pilgrimage. I say hello, Manzanar. I bow at the graves. I speak to the wind of my hopes for afterlife to be a real thing. Not so I can see Grandpa again, but for him to look around today, jump into the circle, dance the tonkobushi, and watch me get it right. And see our friends, all our relations, learn what we mean by chosen family. We are here. Not only to remember, but to remind the local docents, this place will never be a museum. This body will never forget. And we leave pilgrimage with pledges as concrete as the monument. We sing songs to keep each other awake on the long ride home. We lose sight quickly. Rearview mirrors, a pitch black sky, where they close the gate at the hour they have had enough of us, where we leave behind parts of our best poetry, where I hope not, but think Grandpa sits still. waiting. And maybe I'll just go to the one we spoke about earlier on, and it's called Remember All the Children Whom Were Never Born to Me.
Thank you.
Okay. And I usually read it with the redream piece, if that's okay. And you can always cut me off or cut it out after we're done. Remember all the children whom were never born to me. The little raspy voice one who can name all the presidents. The big haired one with a smile that screams for revolution and popsicles. The squeaky retort and gentlefoot one I saw while sitting there at the beach. Every little one I see while sitting anywhere at every awful beach. Versions of a future, a given back in my 20s. All the while I said my window was closing, but I still knew I had time. This was supposed to happen after all or any of them, especially the ones who came to me in my dreams. The curly-haired cutie pie, who rounded the corner off the hallway to up and fly into my arms. I still catch him sometimes while standing here frozen in my kitchen. Or the goofball, who tapped me on the forehead too early in the morning, begging for waffles and presents. I still see them, even after the decorations are taken down. They construct the perfect imperfect child, some tiny one I imagined would be both of my body and dropped off at my door at their age of 2, ready to go, ready to walk, ready to use the toilet on their own. My fantasies don't need to struggle. That little one who would frustrate me, send me to fits, challenge me to the point of knowing I was getting mine. The growing one who would be aging alongside me, feels like they should be, would have been here by now. Actually, yeah, I'll stop right there.
Fantasies don't need struggles. And that last image, of course, of that piece there, that even turning the page, I think, to the now and the image and the last image in the first poem with the grandpa still waiting, and just beautiful, beautiful imagery and heartbreaking and sad and some happiness, all of the above. Thank you so much for sharing all of the art that is you. All of you that is art. I mean, I'm just so blown away. I think we probably talked about 1/3 of all the art that you do, that you put out there in the world. I want to just, again, thank you and just wish you continued great luck with all of the things you're involved in. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. What a fun conversation. Thank you for everything, Peter. Thank you.
Right back at you. What a pleasure. Thank you for listening to episode 120 with Tracy Kato Kuriyama. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music, although we don't want to patronize those last two so much. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube. Please subscribe to both the YouTube channel and the podcast while you're checking out this episode. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look in an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down Instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 121 with Michael Torres, a Vona Distinguished Alum and Canto Mundo Fellow. His first collection of poems, An Incomplete List of Names, through Beacon Press 2020, was selected by Raquel Salas Rivera for the National Poetry Series, named one of NPR's best books of 2020, and was featured on the podcast Code Switch. Michael teaches in the MFA program at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and through the Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop. The episode will air on May 3rd. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers and creatives and artists with mad skills, like Tracy Kato Kiriyama, whose work, like navigating without instruments, gives you chills at will.